From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the great folk guitarist Doc Watson. We'll hear an interview and a live concert. Doc Watson has a distinctive flat pick style of traditional folk and bluegrass. He's also known for preserving the traditional ballads and melodies of Southern Appalachia. The new CD, Sittin' Here Pickin' the Blues, is a remastered and reissued recording featuring Watson and his son, the slide guitarist Merle Watson, who died in 1985. Also, we remember David Dellinger, the political activist who was part of the Chicago Seven. He died this week at the age of 88. Dellinger organized some of the largest anti-war demonstrations in the 1960s. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews The Day After Tomorrow. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq's governing council has chosen a secular Shiite Muslim to be the country's interim prime minister beginning June 30th. Iyad Alawi was congratulated by U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer and U.N. envoy Lakhdar Brahimi. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad.
He's a former surgeon. His uncle was health minister under Saddam Hussein. He's a former Baathist. He was from 1961 to 71. He later lived in exile in Lebanon and London. In 1978, there was an assassination attempt that he survived, believed to have been ordered by Saddam. Since the toppling of Saddam, Alawi has headed the Governing Council Security Committee, and his party, the Iraqi National Accord, includes a number of ex-military officials who oppose Saddam. His cousin is defense minister, so clearly he's got a good grounding in military and security issues.
NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting. There was more fighting today between U.S. troops and Shiite militiamen near the Iraqi holy city of Najaf. Two officials say five Iraqis were killed and 14 wounded. Two U.S. soldiers were also hurt. The fighting came a day after U.S. forces suspended their offensive against militiamen loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett said the militiamen have violated the ceasefire.
Muqtada al-Sadr was very clear that there would be no armed manifestations in Najaf. That includes, in our mind, the city of Kufa as well. While it has been quiet in Najaf, these are, would appear to be, violations of that agreement that he signed his name to.
Kimmett said U.S. forces are giving the ceasefire some time to take hold. At a campaign stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin today, Democratic presidential contender John Kerry faced questions at a veterans rally about ending U.S. involvement in the war in Iraq. NPR's David Wellner reports from Green Bay.
Having voted to leave the decision to invade Iraq up to President Bush, Kerry has generally criticized the planning and execution of that invasion rather than questioning whether U.S. troops should have been sent in the first place. But a woman whose brother was killed fighting in Vietnam demanded that Kerry explain how, if elected president, he would bring U.S. troops home from Iraq. Kerry replied his priority would be to bring in troops from other nations.
I am going to get our troops home as fast as possible with honor and the job accomplished in the way that it needs to be, and we will bring other people into this process.
Kerry's response left the questioners satisfied, even though he avoided making any firm commitments to how soon a troop withdrawal might occur. David Wellner, NPR News, Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 17 points to close at 10,188 in moderate trading. The Dow was up more than 222 points for the week. The Nasdaq gained 2 points today to close at 1987. This is NPR News. Aid workers are trying to get relief supplies to people in Haiti and the Dominican Republic whose homes were destroyed in recent flooding. U.S. Marines on the scene say as many as 1,000 people were killed in one village alone. Many roads have been washed out, so it's difficult to get supplies and medical aid to the victims. Continued bad weather is also making it difficult for rescuers. Reports have emerged that Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has decided to indefinitely postpone putting his Gaza evacuation plan to a cabinet vote Sunday, as widely anticipated. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
According to Israel's Channel 2 television, Prime Minister Sharon has decided not to bring his Gaza plan to a vote Sunday because he lacks a majority of ministers. The postponement would avert a humiliating defeat at the hands of rebellious cabinet members. Polls show that a majority of the Israeli public views Gaza as a quagmire and would like settlers and soldiers to leave it. Sharon's initial plan called for a full withdrawal, but hardline elements in his cabinet disapprove. Sharon's own Likud party rejected his pullout plan earlier this month, and since then the prime minister has been searching for ways to repackage his plan. The latest version calls for settlements to be removed from Gaza in four stages, with a pullout completed by the end of 2005. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Security has tightened at the nation's airport during the Memorial Day weekend. The head of the Federal Aviation Administration urged travelers to report unattended packages or suspicious behavior, and the FBI's photos of seven alleged terrorists have been widely posted. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nike, supporter of the Lance Armstrong Foundation, which helps young people living with cancer live strong. Information at laf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Doc Watson is one of America's most revered folk musicians. For much of his career, he performed and toured with his son, Merle. Merle died in 1985 in a farm accident, just days before Fretz magazine named him finger-picking guitarist of the year in folk, blues, or country music. An annual concert in North Carolina honoring Merle, Merle Fest, wrapped up a few weeks ago. We'll be listening to Terry's 1988 interview with Doc, and we'll hear some songs recorded in a 1989 studio concert. Let's begin with a track from a new collection of songs Doc and Merle recorded in the 1980s called Sittin' Here Pickin' the Blues. This is Blue Ridge Mountain Blues.
When I was young and in my prime, I left my home in Caroline. Now all I do is sit and pine for all the folks I left behind. I've got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I stand right here and say my grip is packed to travel. I'll be scratching gravel for that Blue Ridge far away. I can see two heads of snowy white, and in their window there's a light. It seems I can hear them both recite, oh, where is our wandering boy tonight? I've got them Blue Ridge Mountain blues, and I'll stand right here and say my grip is packed to travel, soon be scratching gravel for that Blue Ridge far away.
Doc Watson is the guitarist who's usually called the single finest flat picker in the country. The only argument you're likely to get about that is from people who don't want to praise his playing at the expense of praising his singing. He was born in Deep Gap, North Carolina. His father was a musician, though not a professional performer, and he got his son to play as well.
Didn't your father make the first banjo that you played?
Yeah, he did. That was in the summer of 1934. Made my first little stringed instrument. I had a harmonica before that. But Dad showed me a few of the old-time Fralin or Clawhammer banjo-style tunes, and one day he brought it to me and put it in my hands and said, "Son, I want you to learn to play this thing real well. Some of these days we'll get you a better one," he said. Might help you get through the world.
And what was it like for you the first time you got the banjo into your hands? What did you do with it?
I really don't remember. I remember how I felt, but I don't remember hardly what it was like learning the first tunes. It was kind of hard for Dad to show me because I couldn't see his hands, and it was a little tough. But he finally got across to me how to do the licks on the banjo and how to note the thing. And I could figure out where the notes were because it was fretless, and you could slide along with your fingers, and finally you come to the right one, you know, and you found out how to get there without missing them.
So you were really pretty self-taught.
For the most part, yes, I was. The guitar, absolutely, I was self-taught.
How did you get your first guitar?
By pulling the crosscut saw that I mentioned at first. One spring, my dad told my youngest brother and I, boys, if you'll cut all those dead chestnut, small dead chestnuts down along the road and around the edge of the field there, you can sell it for pulpwood to the tannery. And we went at it, and we cut a couple of big truckloads. It didn't make us a mint of money, but it made me enough to buy me a good little guitar from, well, I thought it was good at the time, from Sears Roebuck. And my younger brother ordered him a suit of clothes.
Now, considering that your early instruments were homemade banjos and a mail-order guitar, did you ever get really obsessed with the quality of instruments that you were playing? Some musicians just play what they have, and others get really obsessed with having instruments that are just right for them or custom-made for them.
I was fairly contented with what I had. I never had had my hands on a good guitar back in those days, and didn't for years. The first good guitar that I got hold of that I would have considered much better than my mail-order box was a Martin guitar that Richard Green used to have a little music store under his, he had a boarding house or an inn there in Boone. And I went in there one day with that little mail-order thing, and he said, why don't you let me help you get you a good guitar? And I said, gosh, it costs too much. And he said, I'll tell you what I can do. I can get you a good Martin D18 that will be a price that you can afford, and I'll take the payments down to $5 a month. And I couldn't beat that. I paid it off quicker than that, but I couldn't beat that with a stick. And at that time, I was playing at the little fruit stand and a little bean market they had in Boone, and making me a few shekels on Saturday, having a good time of picking, and I paid for the guitar that summer. He got me that thing at his cost, and it cost $90, and I paid for it. Oh, Lord, I was proud of that guitar. But in all truth, compared to my guitar now, it was like fretting a fence. It was really hard to play.
Well, I guess it's almost good in a way to get used to something like that, because it makes it seem so much easier when you get a good guitar.
Oh, it really does. And when I got into the folk revival in the 60s, I ran into people who could set a guitar action up to where you could play it. And I came on to another Martin along about that time. Played a Gibson at first on the road, borrowed. Then I came into another Martin, and the action was brought down to where you could play it.
My guest is Doc Watson. You know, I'm glad you brought up the folk revival. It was really during the folk revival that you started to become nationally known. I think you'd been playing dances and you know, playing
I played
in
rockabilly
your area.
Music through the 50s and played an electric guitar, Les Paul.
Well, see, this really interests me. You were playing rockabilly and an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm. Rockabilly and old pop standards with an old boy named Jack Williams. Jack had a little group together, and when he heard me pick, he said, buddy, I want you to pick with me.
Now, the way I understand it, Ralph Rinsler, who was working at the Smithsonian Institute, came down looking for traditional Southern musicians, came down your way and heard about you.
He was looking for Clarence Ashley and found him, Clarence Tom Ashley. And I had played music with Tom on a few land sales and a few little shows here and there. And Ralph came over, and when he heard me, he persuaded me over my better judgment at the time that I had something to offer in the way of entertainment in the folk revival. So I jumped in there with both hands, I reckon, thinking, well, if I fail at it, it won't mean I didn't try.
Doc Watson speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Doc Watson returned to Fresh Air the following year for a concert.
When the late Jimmy Rogers did his last sessions in the early 30s, he did some music that sat right in the edge of the big band music of that day. Well, here's a pretty little tune old Jim recorded called Blue Eyed Jane. The sweetest girl
in the world lives in my hometown. We fell in love like turtle doves while the moon was shining down. I asked her then, I asked her when the wedding bells would ring. And she said, oh dear, it seems so strange for this to happen here. She is my sugar pie. Oh, to me she is the sweetest gal. I love her so, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, she meets me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane. Pretty Jack. Listen here, Janie dear, I've come to say farewell. Sweetheart, you know I love you so much more than there's words to tell. But I must go away today, honey, won't you come with me? 'Cause I'm gonna be blue, missing you, longing every day for you, my blue-eyed Jane. Hold of me, you are the sweetest thing. I love you so, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, please meet me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane. And when the sun goes down and the shadows creeping over town, then I'll come home to you, my blue-eyed Jane.
Doc Watson recorded in the Fresh Air Studios in 1989. He was accompanied by guitarist Jack Lawrence. More conversation and music with Doc Watson after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with Doc Watson. A collection of songs he recorded in the 1980s with his son Merle has just been released. It's called Sittin' Here Pickin' the Blues.
Once you went on the road during the folk revival, now you weren't used to traveling. There must have been a lot you learned had to learn how to do. Did you have a business manager to help you out with bookings? And
Ralph Rensler did the bookings between he and Manny Greenhill of Folklore Productions. But Ralph traveled a lot with me, and if he didn't, when I went go to New York to work in the city, I came by Trailways bus. Someone would always meet me at the Port Authority and take me over to Ralph's apartment. I worked lots of times. I'd work at Gertie's Folk City a week or 2 weeks at a time, doing either opening act or just playing the job straight there. It was scary. I was as green as a green apple as far as the city. Country boy, really.
Oh, yeah, sure.
As the old-timers used to say, a hayseed for sure. But the scary part finally and the adventure finally got over with, and that road, well, it became a job.
Yeah,
music,
I see what
music,
you mean.
A good audience, I love.
You know, I think there's always clubs who, not maybe not many, but there's always some clubs willing to take advantage of a performer. And I would guess that someone who was blind was a more likely target if they didn't have people who were watching out for them. Would you ever have any problems with that?
I was glad when my son Merle started on the road with me, because if we went to a place and they didn't treat me too good, Dad, we won't come back here anymore. And that was the end of it. I'd tell Manny, I'd tell Mr. Greenhill, don't book that anymore. That was the end of it. We didn't hit too many places that they weren't really decent to us, but once in a great while there, of course I won't call any names because we're on nationwide radio, but we were in a few places where they treated you like pieces of used equipment, and that was the end of playing there. We just didn't do it again. That's the best thing you can do, you know, is not tolerate that. Just move away.
You mentioned your son Merle. Did you teach him how to play guitar?
No. Merle didn't show any interest in the guitar until he was 15. I was on my first concert tour, a little solo concert tour that spring. And about midways of it, Ralph called me and said, Doc, I've got some good news. And I said, well, lay it on me. And he said, Merle has started playing the guitar. His mother, Rosalie, started him on the guitar. She taught him his first chords and showed him how to play them, and a little bit about timing, and he just took it and went with it. And we met John Hurt for the first time that same summer. We went to the Berkeley Folk Festival, and Merle played backup guitar for me. He'd only been playing about 3 months, and he played backup guitar on the stage. And when we met John Hurt, Merle was enthralled by John's finger style on the guitar. And he took that and added a few little notions of his own, and that's where Merle's picking style, finger style, came from.
So he never felt that he had to work hard to differentiate his style from your style?
Merle, he once in a while he'd ask me for some pointers on a melody to a song or something, but Merle played his very own thing on the guitar. I don't think he even ever asked me how to hold the pick. He probably looked at the way I held it, but I never really sat down and taught him how you get this note or that note. I just played a song and sang it, and he jumped in there and learned the lead to it, like Summertime, for instance. I had heard a version of that, and I said, Merle, what do you think about learning this? And I played the thing about halfway through, and he said, gosh, I don't know, that sounds like it'd be hard. And so help me, in 5 minutes he could play the lead to it. And when we did the recording, I'll say this about it, and then we'll move on. When we did the recording, the producer, Jack Clement, came running through and said, boys, don't touch it. It was the first take. He says, that one's the way it should be. And Merle said, well, it was spontaneous. And he said, Dad, I'll have to go back and memorize what I did. Those things happen in the studio a lot of the time. You know, after you learn a song, you'll hear notes that you just reach for, and they're there. And you play things that you hadn't played before.
I've noticed with a lot of musicians that they meet all these people who've memorized their licks and they have no idea what they played. They were just being spontaneous, and everybody else goes and memorizes it. When your son Merle died, was it hard for you to go back on the road afterwards?
if you'll pardon a little intimacy here, I'll tell you something that happened or I wouldn't have. Between the time he was killed and his funeral, I dreamed I was in a dark desert, and it was so hot you couldn't breathe, and the sand was pulling me down like if you were in quicksand, and that big strong hand reached back and said, come on, Dad, you can make it. And he brought me, led me out to where it was cool, but there was a cool, sunny, but there was a cool breeze. And I waked up and I thought, well, I'll try. And I took up the last job on that particular tour that we'd canceled, and my friend Jack Lawrence had been working some while Merle was off the road with us for quite a while, and Jack stayed on as the other guitarist. And I'm kind of glad I did. If I had stayed off the road a month, I never would have come back. It was so hard, you know. You couldn't know, Terry, but it was really hard to go back out there without him.
But I guess that dream kind of gave you permission in a way to do it.
I believe it was godsend, I think, mm-hmm, the dream was.
I want to play a record with you and Merle performing. And this is from an album you recorded together, the Doc Watson, Merle Watson guitar album. And this is Talking to Casey. And Merle Watson is featured on slide guitar.
Was from Doc Watson speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Let's hear another song from the concert he recorded the following year in the Fresh Air Studios.
Jack, I think a good old train song might be in order right here. Son, I remember that song over there that Brother Jimmy Jett wrote. And I'm going to plug an album right here. I ain't supposed to do this, but it's on an album I did for Sugar Hill called Riding the Midnight Train, a bluegrass album, my first endeavor on pure bluegrass. Greenville Trussell is a song for the train buffs that love the good old steam engine sounds and all that good. I remember when I went to school at Raleigh, there was a train went by every 20 minutes on an average. And this song makes me think of those days. I remember as a boy how in wonderment and joy I'd watch the trains as they go by, and the whistle's lonesome sound you could hear for miles around as they rolled across that Greenville Trussell High. But the whistles don't sound like they used to. Lately, not many trains go by. Hard times across this land mean no work for a railroad man. And the Greenville Trussell now don't seem so high.
Doc Watson accompanied by Jack Lawrence. We'll hear more concert and conversation with Doc Watson in the second half of today's show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel about imposters, lovers, and strange Japanese animals. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk more with the great folk guitarist Doc Watson, and we remember longtime peace activist David Dellinger. He organized and led some of the largest anti-war demonstrations of the 60s. He was also one of the Chicago Seven. Dellinger died this week at age 88. Also, a review of the new disaster movie, The Day After Tomorrow. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's 1988 interview with folk music legend Doc Watson. A new CD collection of Doc Watson's songs has just been released. It's called Sittin' Here Pickin' the Blues. It features Doc Watson and his son Merle, who died in a farming accident in 1985.
I've been using the word virtuoso today. And I would guess that one of the problems of being a virtuoso is that people want to hear you play fast all the time, to hear you really, you know, do the most difficult stuff that you can do.
Well, yeah, a lot of people do get into that, but usually if you have a big audience, you can't really take requests from the when you're on stage, so you just program your set and you season it with enough of that to keep the people who love the flashy things satisfied and kind of do a sensible set. I don't mind it if people like to hear the flat picking, and it does give you a boost to get a lot of yells and whistles and screams from the audience, you know, but I love the good solid music too, and most of the audience do, really. When it comes right down to it, they like to hear you, the whole scope of the thing. Being accused of being a virtuoso doesn't bother me as bad as people trying to put me on a pedestal, especially when they're my own age.
What do you mean by putting you on a pedestal?
Well, they act like you're a god or something, you know. Lord, I'm just people. Like everybody else, I do play the guitar, but I had to work awful hard at it to learn what I know.
Why is this more difficult for you to cope with if it's someone your own age saying that?
Because they know better. They should know that I'm people. If it's a high school age or a younger boy or a girl, I let them get away with it. You know, you let them down easy. You don't agree to it, but you let them down easy. But you think somebody up Doc Watson's age would know that Doc's just a normal human being that likes to pick the guitar. He's not a celebrity. I never have felt like I am, you know. And I don't know how to act like a politician.
Can I ask you a question that I hope you don't mind me asking? And if you do, don't answer it. A lot of performers who are blind wear dark glasses when they perform, and that's something you've never done.
I don't know why. I always hated, used to have a good bit of light perception. Doesn't bother me now because most of it's gone. But the reflection off sunglasses, you know how it'll come in on the sides. I guess they make them now, it won't do it. But boy, they used to try to get me to wear them. I reckon they didn't like the way my eyes looked. A lot of people would say you ought to wear sunglasses. I hated them. I wouldn't do it. And I just never have worn them. I don't know if the blind that wear them, their eyes look really abnormal or what. I don't know. I never did care to wear them, just didn't do it.
Right.
No particular reason except what I told you.
Yeah, well, I could certainly understand that. I mean, I don't understand why they need to be worn by, I guess it's preference, just whether you want to wear them or not.
I suppose, yeah.
One last thing. You know, there's a really nice recording on the album that we heard earlier from the early 60s of you and your wife singing together. Does she still sing? Do you ever sing together?
She doesn't sing anymore or play anymore. The tragedy of losing Merle, Terry, has just about undone her. She does the office work there at home, but she's not Rosalie anymore. Bless her little heart. I don't know, sometimes I just want to cry. And, you know, especially when I'm away from her, I do, when I think about it. I try not to and try to encourage her what I can. But it's been tough on her, and she can't seem to get over the loss. The grief really has her yet.
Yeah, I can understand. Well, you'll be able to spend more time together when you retire. I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming, for talking with us about music, and thank you very much. And I hope you have a good continuing year on the road.
I'll guarantee you it's been a pleasure.
Doc Watson speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Doc and his wife Rosalie still live in Deep Gap, North Carolina, where he was born. He just celebrated his 81st birthday. Let's hear one more song from the concert Doc Watson recorded in Fresh Air Studios in 1989 with his longtime accompanist Jack Lawrence.
I think we'll do one that my son Merle and I learned from John Hurt. A good old tune called Make Me Down a Pallet on Your Floor. Make me
down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. I'm going up the country through that sleet and snow. Going up the country through that sleet and snow. Yes, I'm going up the country through that sleet and snow. Ain't no telling just how far I'll go. Getting my breakfast here and my dinner in Tennessee. Get breakfast here and dinner in Tennessee. Gonna get my breakfast here, my dinner in Tennessee. Told you I was coming, so you better look for me. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. What do you think about it, Jack? Yeah, I like that notion right there. Well, you know that I can't lay down on your bed.
Doc Watson and Jack Lawrence recorded in 1989. Rounder has just released Sittin' Here Pickin' the Blues, old recordings of Doc and his son Merle. Jack Lawrence has a new album, too, called I Don't Need the Whiskey Anymore. Coming up, we'll listen back to an interview with peace activist David Dellinger. He died Tuesday at the age of 88. This is Fresh Air. Peace activist David Dellinger died Tuesday. He was 88. He devoted his life to nonviolent protests against war, racism, and social injustice. He helped organize some of the largest demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. And in 1969, as one of the Chicago Seven, he stood trial alongside Abbie Hoffman on charges of conspiring to riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. His critics could hardly blame Dellinger's upbringing for his politics. His parents were conservative Republicans. His grandmother was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. Dellinger, like his father, went to Yale, but then his life took a completely different direction. In 1940, while studying at the Union Theological Seminary, he refused to register for military service. That resulted in the first of two prison sentences he served for resisting the draft. Terry Gross spoke to David Dellinger in 1993. His memoir, From Yale to Jail, had just been published. He said it was in jail that he first tested his nonviolent principles.
When I was in Lewisburg Prison, my second prison term, which was for 2 years, a young fellow came to me one morning, terrified, said that three people had come to his cell the night before to rape him. And that somehow he had staved them off. Maybe the guards, you know, came nearby or something. But anyway, he staved them off, and they said that they're going to be here tonight, and they're going to do it. And I knew I had to help him, and I didn't know how. And I guess I had some desperate idea that maybe if the way the hierarchies worked in prison, that if I challenged the leader and beat him in a fight, that the others would actually allow a fair fight, and then if I won, they would go away.
What happened?
Well, what happened was that I didn't want to fight, but I was prepared to. And so when they came, well, first of all, I had somebody, you know, they have keys that you can get out of your, they had there at least, that you can get out of your cell. And so I had my next door the cell next door, who was a bank robber and had one of those to get me out of my cell at the time that they would come, you know, when the lights were out and the guards went away for a while. And I went down to this fellow's cell and I stood there and I got there before they did. And when they came, I said, "Hi, guys, how are you?" You know, or something like that. And I started talking with them. So, you know, I started talking about, you know, I was just up in the hole, and have you guys, I suppose you've been there too. And then I asked them about their raps, you know, what they were in for and so forth, because I was new in that cell block. I'd just been transferred there when that happened. And I did establish something, but there came a time when we'd really become friends, and I told them about some of my experiences and they about theirs and our families and so forth. But they weren't going away, and a couple of the guys, because there were four of them, a couple of them were kind of restless around the edges, and I could see the time might be when they'd say, get the F out of the way, you know, we're going in. And so at that point, I said something along these lines. You know, I heard that some people had been threatening to rape my friend Bill, and I came down because, well, I'd already talked about him a little, you know, which I won't repeat now, about what a nice guy he was and how he had been fighting for prisoners' rights and so forth. Because I said, I hate to have anything like that happen to him. Then I said, so I came down here to protect him, and I decided that if somebody came with a shiv, which was a prison knife made in the same machine shops as the keys that I talked about, which and they had had one then, previous night. See, if somebody came down here, they'd have to stick a shiv into me before they stuck it into him. And I'm so relieved to know that it's you guys and you wouldn't do that. And
were they flattered?
Well, the two that had been restless and hadn't engaged in the conversation much just disappeared. Next thing I knew, they weren't there. And then the second guy left, and so finally the leader, a guy, his name was Steele, and he had the most steely eyes and manner I've ever known. And he said in some swear words, you know, holy, I never heard such a thing. You'd let us stick a shiv into you in order to save him. And he just was floored in a admiring way.
Yeah.
And so then we walked away together, and after that, we were all friends, and they never bothered him. And I was just, I had, for reasons, I wasn't afraid during it when that happened, but as soon as I got into the room, I began to sob. I began to cry and shook all over.
Now, I want to contrast this to a time later in your life when you also tried to use language and principles of nonviolence, and it didn't work. And I'm thinking at a demonstration that you were at where there was a really noisy, aggressive, bullying guy. And how did you handle that? What did you say?
Well, I was up on the step ladder from which we were talking. It was during the Korean War. And I was worried because he was yelling so much. And also, a couple of our supporters had sort of put their arms around him, and I was worried about that maybe they wouldn't be totally nonviolent. So finally, I said, "If you want to hit somebody, I'll come down and you can hit me." But I had not established a proper bond with him. I did it wrong, and so I went down there, and he came rushing at me, and I sidestepped a couple of times, and then I trying to talk to him to establish the bond as I had in prison. And then finally I realized I wasn't living up to my word, so I stood there with my arms to my side, and he hit me, knocked me out, broke my jaw, and caused an injury to an eye, which right now I'm legally blind, have been for years, because my eye never recovered from that.
Besides the physical damage that that blow caused, did it cause you also to challenge any of your principles or to say, well, I'll never make that offer again. If you want to hit somebody, hit me.
It challenged me to be smarter and to establish a better bond before, because one has to combine common sense with everything else.
A lot of the people in the 60s anti-war movement had conflicts with their parents about politics. Did you have conflicts with your parents about politics? Your parents were conservative Republicans.
Yes, I had conflicts with them. I was in Divinity School when the draft law was passed, and I was exempt if I just signed my name registered. But I thought that was a bribe. You know, some people are religious or can't kill people, and so we will exempt them, but the ordinary people will do the real work of society. And when I told my father I was not going to register for the draft, He said he would commit suicide if I didn't do it. So that shows how badly he felt. And I talked to him. It was on the phone. And I talked to him for over an hour when I was convinced that he wouldn't do it. But even with that, we still maintained some kind of, I don't know what to call it, camaraderie or something. But he thought I was throwing my life away by going to prison. And he had transferred some of his ambitions to me, his oldest son.
That's a very, really manipulative thing for a parent to do. I'm going to kill myself if you do this action.
That's right.
Did you feel responsible? Did you feel like, well, in that case, you know, did you feel at all? In that case, well, maybe I should consider registering for the draft. I can't take responsibility for my father.
No, I loved my father, but I don't think I considered not registering. What I considered that my duty was to persuade him not to kill himself, and mm-hmm. I would not. And actually, he said to me, if you hang up, I will kill myself immediately. And I talked to him for a long time and was till I was convinced. And I, when our children were growing up and he came to visit us, was one of the things that brought us closer together, because he was always worried, you know, you won't have enough money to send your kids to college or to treat, you know, have them buy them the things they need. And we were very poor by choice, something close to what Dorothy Day called voluntary poverty, although I never quite liked that word. That phrase. And he said, my gosh, your kids are so wonderful, you know. And he loved the fact that we had an organic garden. Even if he was a lawyer, he would have loved to have spent more time in the garden than he was able to. And so step by step, so that by the end of his life, he said to me that he had decided that I had chosen the way of life that he valued and that he thought was right. Hmm. And that was shortly before he died.
You were one of the organizers of the protest at the Chicago Democratic National Convention. And you were one of the Chicago Seven indicted for conspiring to
Chicago
cause...
Eight.
Chicago Eight originally, yeah.
Yeah, don't forget Bobby Seale.
No, he was absolutely, right.
The most mistreated of us all and with the least justification.
Well, you eight were charged with conspiring to cause a riot. Did that strike you as ironic, the Mr. Nonviolent Resistance?
Well, of course it struck me as ironic. But first of all, the conspiring, because I didn't even know some of the other people with whom I was charged of conspiring, including Bobby Seale. None of us knew Bobby Seale. And actually, the prosecutor in his opening statement said that Mr. Dellinger was the architect of the violence that took place. And of course, what they did was to accuse me of pretending to be nonviolent and leading a nonviolent march so it would distract the police while the others went into the center of town and rioted. And it was just a total falsity. Even the presidential commission said it was a police riot.
How has your life changed when the war in Vietnam ended and the war that you had been organizing against no longer was an issue?
Well, I think I was... First of all, my life wasn't changed that much because it's still an unjust society and my struggle always has been for justice. So, but the way in which it was improved for me, especially after the trial died down and all that publicity that I hated because it made us look like we were heroes and anything which, first of all, it's never quite true, you know. And one of my son, with my encouragement, changed his name. Because everywhere he went, you know, people say, oh, are you Dave's? So I felt relieved when I got out of that business.
Out of the limelight.
Yes. But also, I always tried to emphasize grassroots. And I lived in a small, intentional community. And I worked in a slum in Newark, for example, working with youth gangs and that kind of thing. And I was with great reluctance that step by step I got pushed to be like chairman or co-chairman of these committees and to speak at the demonstrations. I didn't mind speaking at the demonstrations, but I didn't like the emphasis of some people that all that counted was what happened nationally, because I think that the revolution or decency, whatever you want to say, begins in one's own heart, in one's own life, in one's family, in one's neighborhood, one's place of work. I often quote Charlie Parker, the jazz musician, who says, jazz comes from who you are, where you've been, what you learned. If you haven't lived it, it won't come out of your horn. And I often quote that and say that's the way I believe in about politics. If you don't live it in your own life, it won't come out of your horn.
Terry Gross speaking with activist David Dellinger in 1993. Dellinger died Tuesday at the age of 88. This is Fresh Air. The Day After Tomorrow is the first disaster movie in which the end of civilization is brought about not by an alien invasion or asteroid, but by global warming and the next ice age. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
If I had to catalog all the moronic plot turns in The Day After Tomorrow, we'd be here until the next ice age. It's just so very bad. You can actually have a pretty good time snickering at it, unless, like me, you think there's something to this global warming thing. And you shudder at the irony of a movie made to warn people about a dangerous environmental trend, completely discrediting it. By now you know the premise. Global warming melts the polar ice caps, which makes the oceans rise and disrupts the Gulf Stream. Paleoclimatologist Dennis Quaid saw this coming, of course, but no one high up in the administration would listen. The first half hour is full of standard corny disaster movie foreplay, and it's kind of fun to be ahead of everyone on screen. Quaid gets introduced to Ian Holm as an expert named Terry Rapson at a conference and says, "Professor Rapson? I've read your work on ocean currents. I just love that stuff." Climatologists stare into their screens while munching on some piece of food and say, "That's strange. The temperature at George's Banks just dropped 13 degrees. Must be a broken sensor." Idiot! Hasn't he seen the previews? Here, Quaid mixes it up with Kenneth Welsh as an obvious stand-in for Vice President Dick Cheney.
Mr. Vice President.
Tom.
You know Professor Hall?
Yes, we've met.
Professor Hall has some new information I think you should take a look at.
We just got these results from our simulation model. They explain what's causing the severe weather.
Look, I'll have to look at this later. I have a meeting with the director of FEMA right now.
This is very urgent, sir. Our climate is changing violently, and it's going to happen over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
I thought you said this wouldn't happen for another 100 years or so.
I was wrong.
Well, suppose you're wrong this time.
I wish that I were, but I'm sure that you're aware of what's happening all around the world.
Look, we're making all the necessary preparations for this storm. What more do you expect?
You have to start thinking about large-scale evacuations right now, especially in the northern states.
Evacuations?
Yes.
Have you lost your mind, Hall? I have to go.
Mr. Vice President! If we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
The filmmakers can get away with all that bum dialogue early on because we're still in a state of happy anticipation. It's a kind of therapy to see our fictional counterparts die in horrible ways, our cities crumble, our deepest anxieties realized. But the director of The Day After Tomorrow is Roland Emmerich, the man responsible for three of the clunkiest summer blockbusters ever made, Independence Day, Godzilla, and The Patriot. And Emmerich thinks that audiences will show up to see the big special effects, but what will keep them in their seats is the presence of recognizable human beings with recognizable human problems. I couldn't agree more, except that when it comes to weaving the personal stories in and out of the special effects set pieces, Emmerich has the most colossal anti-talent since Ed Wood Jr. In the midst of the tornadoes leveling L.A. and lethal hailstones pelting Tokyo, the flooding of Manhattan, the temperature drop of 10 degrees per second, the deaths of tens of millions, absentee dad Quaid announces he's going to snowshoe from Washington, D.C. to Manhattan, where his teenage son, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, is holed up in the New York Public Library making cow eyes at Emmy Rossum. "Your dad will never make it," says someone, and Gyllenhaal says, "He'll make it." And it's a testament to the actor's smarts that he knows how to soft pedal that line so that it doesn't bring down the house. The Day After Tomorrow ends up feeling weirdly underpopulated because the scenes aren't thought out in terms of the movements of the masses, but the soap opera tribulations of the few, each of whom gets his or her own little moment of heroism, like Celia Ward as Quaid's ex-wife, a pediatric oncologist who remains at the bedside of a little boy with no hair as her clinic empties out. How are the FX? Good. Although at this point, most of us recognize computer-generated imagery, and so we register on some level that it's a computerized Antarctic ice sheet cracking, and a computerized Hollywood sign being blown away by a computerized tornado. The other problem is that all the cool effects, the destruction of L.A., the tidal waves, the car crashes, come early. The last part of the movie is people getting very, very cold, which is not that photogenic, although Emmerich shoots Gyllenhaal being chased by an Arctic chill as if it's Godzilla. The sad part is that Emmerich really thinks he's making a political statement. He even has the vice president admit on national television, "I was wrong," which might actually be the movie's most far-fetched moment. Global warming experts I know are already girding themselves for a major PR setback. Is it possible that The Day After Tomorrow is a plot to make environmental activists look as wacko as the anti-environmentalists always claim they are?
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, who also recorded our concert with Doc Watson. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Pettis Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And from Knopf, publisher of Eventide, the new novel by Kent Harif, author of Plainsong. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, in honor of Memorial Day, we remember the soldiers who fought in World War II and a journalist who died telling their stories. We'll talk with biographer James Tobin about the war correspondent beloved by the public, GIs, and generals alike, Ernie Pyle. Join us for the next Fresh Air.